Thank you for your nice introduction. You see, when you're getting older, you forget to blush. You see, if I would be 20 years younger, I would blush. But now you sit there and you think what we call in Germany is selbstverständlich. You see, that's the consequence of becoming older and older. Well, I was very happy in my curriculum. I didn't discover one thing. Because generally when I speak in America, I always say, I was in love with the United States from the first day of my life. Because I have been born on the 4th of July. And I'm always afraid, because once a man in New Orleans discovered it, and he was the manager of the whole thing there in New Orleans, and he said, Dr. Hunold has been born on the 4th of July for public relations reason. Well, it is a great honor for me to talk in the Philadelphia Society. And there is even a special thing. It is my first after-dinner talk. You see, when you're getting older, younger people put you in. You see, when I was secretary, I put older people in. So now the thing has been turning. And they have put me as a dinner speaker. And I remember Salvador de Madariaga. I think in America he is not known. You see, he was never on the cover page of Time. But perhaps some people may know him. Salvador de Madariaga, I put him once after dinner, an after dinner speaker, and he got furious. But it was printed, and he had to speak. But before he talked, he made an introduction and told a story 2,000 years ago when Emperor Nero was in the Roman Empire. In the Colosseum, there was one of these Christians, and Nero had three lions to eat this Christian. And then he shouted, "Open the door for the first lion!" The lion jumped in, the smelling on this Christian. Then he took his ear, the Christian, and whispered something in his ear. Consequence, the lion turned, put his tail between his leg, and walked out. Nero got furious. "Open the door for the second lion!" The lion jumped in, lifted his ear, whispered something, turned him, tail between the leg, walked out too. Then the last lion was called. The same thing. The last lion, he walked out too. Then Nero said, "Well, call this Christian dog, that he may creep to my feet." Christian came. He said, "You have bewitched my lion." Christian said, "No, I haven't bewitched your lion. I just whispered something into their ear." "What did you whisper?" "Well, I said, lion, if you eat me, you have to deliver a speech after dinner." By the way, when I came over here on Wednesday, I saw a note in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, Salvador de Madariaga left Spain after the Civil War, and now after 40 years, he went back last Monday, and he's now in Spain. He will deliver a speech in the university, and on the 23rd of June, he is 90 years old, and he wanted to celebrate his 90th birthday in his home country. He was a member of the Montpellier Society, too. Now, ladies and gentlemen, more than 50 years ago, just after the end of the First World War, the German historian and philosopher Oswald Spengler, in his Decline of the West, said that the greatest danger of our time would be when class war would form a gang with race war in order to make an end to the white world. What Spengler prophesied long ago has happened in Mozambique and has happened in Angola and may soon be happening in Rhodesia and repeated in Namibia and perhaps also in the center of the main gold producer of the Western world, in the Republic of South Africa. Tyrants, bandits, puppets have come to power, said quite recently Alexander Solzhenitsyn on the occasion of his first visit to England, and pragmatic philosophy says that doesn't matter. We have to recognize them. And what is more, said Solzhenitsyn, one should not consider that the great principles of freedom finish at our own frontier. That as long as you have freedom, let the rest have pragmatism. No, freedom is invisible, and one has to take a moral attitude towards it. All my life, says Solzhenitsyn, and the life of my generation, the life of those who share my views, we all have one standpoint: better to be dead than a scoundrel. In this horrible expression of the English philosopher Bertrand Russell, better red than dead, there is an absence of all moral criteria. Look at from a short distance, these words allow one to maneuver and to continue to enjoy life, but from a long-term point of view, it will undoubtedly destroy those people who think like that. It is a terrible thought. This brings me right into the main problem of our time: the preservation of the free world, the bourgeois world, and in our topic, the good society, or, if you like, the conservative world. I do hope you may not find it superfluous if I tell you that there has taken place in some countries in Europe a considerable awakening in the last 3 or 4 years. My country, Switzerland, has always been considered a bourgeois country par excellence, although Lenin, another but less desired Russian refugee in my hometown of Zurich, pretended that Switzerland is the most revolutionary country of the world. When he failed with the world revolution, with a torch in Switzerland, he became silent. But I would like to draw your attention on our neighbor country, Germany, undoubtedly the country in which the destiny of Europe and of the free world will be determined. A simple allusion to certain developments for the present in the spiritual moral front may suffice. Since about 1972, I have been traveling in Germany and went practically to all important congresses, especially in the evangelical academies. And in these academies, since 1972-73, the topic, the main topic, was all this conservative movement. What you had in the beginning of the 60s, the Germany had in the beginning of the 70s. And I just want to draw your attention to one congress, or to two. In February 73, I was in Hof Geismar, and I met there Schrenk Notzing, and he published, since 1971, Criticon, a journal of which Dr. Molnar is one of the main contributors. Next year, in February 1974, I was in the Evangelical Academy at Tutzing in Bavaria. My topic was, main topic was again conservatism, and a man was the speaker in Hofgeismar the year before, and in this meeting too, and in three or four other meetings, this is Gerd Klaus Kaltenbrunner, a young man, who is publishing now a publication in the Herdebücherei called Herdebücherei Initiative. You see, you have here the 11th volume, and there is always one topic treated by a lot of people, a book which has an enormous success now. I have here, just before I left Zurich, I received this number, Die Macht der Meinungsmacher, The Might of the Opinion Makers, and these books are very interesting and read by the young generation. I have been, just a fortnight before I came over to America, I went to Essen, and there was another man whom you know better than Salvador Madariaga, William Schlamm. William Schlamm, he published the Zeitbühne, Molnar is also a contributor to the Zeitbühne, since 1972, and I was interested how William Schlamm, I think you know him better, he was one of the founders of the National Review, he founded or helped Henry Luce and so on. He was talking in the CDU, a big hall, place for about 1,000 people. Unfortunately, there was a football match and everybody, every idiot was before the screen. And I came in a quarter of an hour before the thing began. There were about 12 persons in the room. But between a quarter to eight, to eight o'clock, the whole thing was full, about 800 or 900 people. William Schlamm had a great success, and there I could see that the young generation is not only reading, they are swallowing these conservative books. And then there was a discussion after his 50 minutes lecture of 1 hour and a half. And it was terrific to see the young generation between 17, 18, 19, 20 and so on. They were talking about 20 young people. One after the other came, put questions and so on. And this is a very interesting thing, this great conservative movement. Now, all this, ladies and gentlemen, is epoch-making. And a similar movement as the conservative movement, as I already said, in the USA in the 60s. But now, let me come back to the master singer of the bourgeois world, Wilhelm Röpke, this indefatigable fighter for our cause. Our cause, for our great and unique cause, the preservation of a free world. Let me just turn the clock back for 43 years in order to do justice to Röpke and make allusion to his speech he delivered just a week after Hitler came to power, a speech delivered at Frankfurt on Main under the title The Turn of an Epoch. A speech which is full of stirring actuality. One cannot mobilize, said Röpke in 1933, the masses against reason, peace, and freedom without producing an economical catastrophe. One cannot go back in the jungle of Germany, preach mass stupidity, and create a storm of destructive and dissolute emotions while the apparatus of mass supply is becoming more and more difficult and appeals to the intelligence and discipline of men. A catastrophe will come if men are becoming more and more stupid and barbarous while the technique and the organization of the economy is becoming more and more refined. This is just the situation in which we are standing and the enormous danger which is threatening us. The possibility exists that the old and sad drama of the decline of an old and flourishing culture may be repeated, but this possibility should not paralyze the forces of our resistance, but mobilize them to unsurmountable strength. In case when later our expectations should become reality, no one should make an approach to himself that in the hour of utmost danger he had been lukewarm, opportune, cowardly, and an adorator of the silly news of the day. 3 weeks later, on February 27, 1933, Röpke left Germany with his family in order to accept an invitation of Atatürk to the University of Istanbul. And while staying a few days in Holland, the Nazis sent him a delegation of the SS inviting him to come back. From Turkey, he sent once a letter to his admired friend and Italian nobleman, Count Carlo Sforza. He wrote, "For us who have turned their back to our fatherland like you, it is a pity that only very few non-Jews and non-Marxists have preferred freedom of conviction to serfdom in Germany. It is interesting how you combine love to your country with the opposition to the actual regime." When did Wilhelm Röpke, ladies and gentlemen, start his great fight for a preservation of a free world? A world of good citizens, eine bürgerliche Welt, a world with a sound spiritual nucleus, the conservative mind. It was on one of the loveliest spots on the Lake of Lucerne at Salisburg when I had organized two meetings of the Mont Pelerin Society, one in 1949 and the other in 1953. In 1949, the subject of Röpke's speech was proletarianization, or more generally, the development towards a growing number of people who, in spite of satisfactory wages and short working hours, may lack the conditions of a balanced, humanly satisfactory, and vitally normal existence. People uprooted, dependent, without reserves and natural anchors of life, without property, and without a mentality going with a well-rooted middle-class existence of men who, by having property and the sense of property, have a tangible stake in the existing order and a genuine contact with nature and the community. In 1953, Röpke, like a criminal, returned to the place of his misdeed 4 years ago. He even went further than that and committed the crime a second time, because in the first meeting he had great opposition. I don't mention the name of the people who opposed him. "At this very place," he argued, "I spoke 4 years ago of a subject which arose some criticism. I did it in a manner which was liked even less by some of my listeners. My point was that we may have a market economy and at the same time dangerously unsound social conditions, for which the market economy itself is surely not responsible, but which every advocate of it has strong reason to improve, or at least to wish to see improved, in order to make the market economy permanently possible, both politically and socially, and also to satisfy our desire to have not only a market economy, but a sound social system and happy people as well. The third act of Röpke's Odyssey, which was not a wandering of Ulysses at all, happened in 1957 at Bad Godesberg near Bonn in a lecture delivered in the Aktionsgemeinschaft Soziale Marktwirtschaft, founded by Röpke's friend Alexander Rüstow of the University of Heidelberg. The topic was Marktwirtschaft ist nicht genug, market economy is not sufficient. The questionable things of this world, Röpke said, perish on their own nature, while the good things perish from its excesses. And he continued, and all friends of conservatism would become attentive, by saying that the conservative ideal of order, of preservation, and of tradition is closely connected with a sound society, but in the extreme, we are running the risk of freezing, handcuffing, and injustice. We must therefore have a counterweight in the form of liberale Vorliebe, he said, libertarian preference, for movement and for continuous measurement of all forces. But when these forces for progress become unlimited and do not make a halt before the stability and permanence, the consequence will be disintegration and destruction. Carrying things to excess, as it is the case with collectivism, is just as dangerous as exaggerated individualism. All this is leading into anarchism. Private property will end in plutocracy, authority in despotism, democracy in a society of the masses, arbitration and demagogy. Suicide will be the inevitable consequence when these limits will be disregarded, and we shall have reached the point prophesied by the pessimists like Spengler, the decline of the West. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we stand before Röpke's final act. He finished in 1958, Jenseits von Angebot und Nachfrage, with a brilliant English title, A Humane Economy, published by the president of the Philadelphia Society, Henry Regnery. It is the shadow of Wilhelm Röpke, a book to be read and studied by every conservative, being the focus of social philosophy and guidepost for all of us willing to defend the good society against our enemies. Perhaps you may allow me to conclude this chapter with a word from the laudatory on the occasion of the granting of the Pirkheimer Medaille to Wilhelm Röpke in the year 1965, a few months before he died. Das Maß der Wirtschaft ist der Mensch. Das Maß des Menschen ist sein Verhältnis zu Gott. The measure of the economy is a man. The measure of man is his relation to God. Now let me finally come to a topic which can be considered as the main problem of our time, inflation, which one of the greatest experts in this field, Jacques Rueff of Paris, has characterized in the sentence, Le sort de l'homme joue sur la monnaie. Money is the destiny of man. Let us have a look to a country winner of the Second World War, like the USA, Great Britain, a country which is playing a preponderous role in Europe bicentennial this year, a most interesting show window in the field of economic policy as well as of foreign policy. In the letters of Wilhelm Röpke, published on the occasion of 10 years since his death, a friend of Röpke says that the spiritual grave diggers of this once great and proud country were Sydney and Bertie Swann, Lord Keynes, and Lord Beveridge. The unholy alliance between collectivism and Keynesism has ruined this country, and it's going to ruin other European countries as well. And the intellectual general staff for this road to serfdom is a man who quite recently has been honored by the Nobel Prize Foundation together with Professor Hayek, Gunnar Myrdal. A rather strange distinction in pair, a defender of the free world like Hayek on the one side, and a Sovietophile, an anti-American socialist Myrdal. A great puzzle for every reasonable man, similar to the strange pair distinguished in the field of foreign policy, Le Duc d'O on the one side and Henry Kissinger on the other. Early in the year 1936, a few months before he left Istanbul for Geneva in order to become a professor at the Graduate Institute of International Studies, Röpke wrote to Gottfried Haberl of Harvard University after having finished reading the book of John Maynard Keynes, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money. And he said, "We may be in agreement, dear Haberl, that Keynes said very important things which should be taken seriously, but is handling in a most frivolous way with dynamite. The question is, what shall be done? I see in advance that the discussion will go on in terminological finesses, in this dreadful new English jargon, which I cannot read anymore. On the other side, to many of our closest friends, the general attack of Keynes would react with a complete lack of comprehension and could not be of great help to us. I believe, therefore, that the number of those who could digest Keynes may not be too big, and you and I are among this small number. I have indeed the feeling that we are in the most critical moments of our science. What are your plans?" Only 4 days earlier, Röpke wrote a similar letter to Hayek. All this happened 40 years ago, and now, 40 years later, ladies and gentlemen, we are all topsy-turvy. Every one of us may appreciate to read the confession of Hayek in his Nobel Memorial Prize lecture held on December 11, 1974 at Stockholm. An excellent scientific essay indeed. We may exercise tolerance towards Hayek for not continuing his fight against Keynes. But what should we say for his recent proposal for a solution of the problem of inflation? Just a few days ago, before I left Zurich, I received a pamphlet from a London institute entitled Choice of Currency, A Way to Stop Inflation, written by Professor Hayek. "What is so dangerous," says Hayek in this pamphlet, "and ought to be done away with, is not government's right to issue money, but the exclusive right to do so, and their power to force people to use it and to accept it at a particular price. This monopoly of government, like the postal monopoly, has its origin not in any benefit it secures for the people, but solely in the desire to enhance the coercive powers of government. But why should we not let people choose freely what money they want to use? By people, I mean the individuals who ought to have the right to decide whether they want to buy or sell for francs, pounds, dollars, D-mark, or ounces of gold. I have no objection to governments issuing money. But I believe," said Hayek, "their claim to a monopoly or their power to limit the kinds of money in which contracts may be concluded within their territory, or to determine the rates at which money can be exchanged, to be wholly harmful. Let me mention just one of the commentaries published on Hayek's paper. Douglas Jay, member of the English Parliament, economic secretary to the Treasury and later financial secretary, and for 3 years president of the Board of Trade, wrote the following comment. In this paper, Choice of Currency, Professor Hayek seems to have been led astray either by his lifelong quarrel with Lord Keynes or else by the ancient fallacy, now common, of believing that if one system does not yield ideal results, anything else would do better. He wants governments to refrain from declaring anything legal tender, and all individuals to use what money they like. He says that people should be free to refuse any money they distrusted and to prefer money in which they had confidence. But, Dr. Jay continues, suppose I offer one paper ruble in payment of a bus fare and the conductor refuses to accept it. What happens? Is the bus stopped while the conductor and I seek a ruling which nobody can give? And imagine the controversies in the bus over the latest exchange rate between the one currency and any other. Professor Hayek's new scheme would produce chaos and slow down the whole business of production and exchange in a welter of disputation. That is why history has forced governments to legislate on legal tender. Professor Hayek might nearly as well ask for the abolition of all law courts and indeed governments, and let every individual prosecute his own disputes. Such an argument is no doubt superficial, but human history argues rather strongly against it. The proper answer, in the words of Wilhelm Röpke, to this new monetary thesis of Hayek would be what I told you earlier, carrying things to excess, as it is the case with collectivism, is just as dangerous as exaggerated individualism and leads into anarchism. But I may even go further than that and mention the foundation of what has long been called neoliberalismus, and what the closest friend of Röpke, Alexander Rüstow, said in an intervention on a conference of the Verein für Sozialpolitik in September 1932 at Dresden, a few years before Hitler came to power. Rüstow's conclusion is the following. I read you my translation and not the German text. The neoliberalism, in any case, who can be advocated and for whom I plead together with my friends, demands a strong state, a state above the economy and above vested interests. See, if I say strong state, that doesn't mean, it's not identical with big government, what you said this morning. And with this confession to a strong state in the interest of a liberal economic policy and to liberal economic policy in the interest of a strong state, these two things are conditioning each other. With this confession, I may close, said Rüstow on his conference, this remarkable conference, the last meeting of the Verein für Sozialpolitik in September 32. In January, the society was liquidated. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let me come to an end with another allusion to Röpke's friend Alexander Rüstow. In a lecture given on the occasion of his promotion to an honorary degree at the University of Bern under the title Human Rights or Human Duties, he said that in the face of the situation, when the center of all natural right, freedom, undergoes a deadly threat, it seems to me that it is not sufficient any longer to term it according to tradition as right, because of what use would it be to the subjugated beyond the Iron Curtain if he told them that they had a right to freedom? And what use is it to us whose freedom is threatened from beyond if one tells us you have a right to freedom? In Risto's view, the world demands of us a new turn in our thinking in regard to natural right, a turn from the right to the duty. It follows, therefore, that for us here in the West, we still possess our freedom. It is high central duty based on the natural right to do everything possible in common to keep our freedom, and that, furthermore, it is our natural duty to help as best as we can all those who have lost their freedom against their will to recover their lost freedom. It follows, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, for our behavior as defenders of a free society, first, to follow stringent moral rules, as Solzhenitsyn did when he said, better to be dead than a scoundrel. Second, renounce a thing when our conscience said, this is immoral. Third, have the conscience to do a thing when it is moral, and to do it with glowing, fighting spirit, and not lukewarm, remembering the harsh words of the Bible, the revelation of St. John, the divine, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth.